The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello again, and we come to this week's podcast bearing both good and bad news. The good news is that we have a great winner of the Royal Society Prize for Science Book of the Year. The bad news is that the Royal Society has announced that the future of the prize is in jeopardy. And more bad news. There are rumblings that the D.H. Lawrence Centre in the author's home village of Eastwood may close. Martin Amis and Salman Rushdie among the authors who have rushed to its defence. But the good news, as Martin Wainwright discovered this week when he paid a visit to the centre, is that the town that Lawrence made famous is not going to relinquish its claims on its most famous son so easily.
People do have a fondness here when they come, and a lot of people that do come are people that love Lawrence, or they're coming because they love the Victorian, or they remember it from their childhood.
We'll hear more from Martin later. But first, let's go to the week's Big Books Prize, which was awarded last night by the Royal Society for the Science Book of the Year. With me in the studio to discuss it is the novelist Tracy Chevalier, who's one of the judges, and Sarah Crown, editor of the Guardian Books website. Hello, both of you.
Hi.
Now, we're going to go for the cliffhanger effect here. Sarah, would you just run us through the shortlist?
Yes, in no particular order, they were A World Without Ice by Henry Pollack, Everyday Practice of Science, Where Intuition and Passion Meet Objectivity and Logic by Frederick Grinnell, God's Philosophers, How the Medieval World Laid the Foundations of Modern Science by James Hannam, Life Ascending by Nick Lane, We Need to Talk About Kelvin by Marcus Chown, which surely gets the prize for best title, and Why Does E Equal MC Squared by Brian Cox and Jeff Forshaw.
Did I hear a little hesitation about that equation there, Sarah?
Yes. I haven't done equations since
You're not
GCSE.
not a natural maths reader, then.
No, it's not my area.
Tracy, there are some quite crunchy titles in here. Everyday Practice of Science. I mean, I'm not going to read that, am I? Are these books for everyone?
You know, I think that you might read that book if it had a better cover and was actually marketed for the general public. Particularly the scientists among the judges loved this book because it was about the passion that scientists have. You know, we all think of the scientific method of scientists with lab coats and, oh, yes, they're all number crunching and all that. And actually, scientists work through intuition and passion. And this book describes that as well as everything else about how science works. And I think that it really stood a good chance of being a more popular book if it had been marketed by the publisher more properly. On the other hand, some marketing can be a little hard to take. For instance, We Need to Talk About Kelvin.
Yeah,
you love that title. I hate that title.
Yeah, I hate that title. I think that Sarah loves it ironically, actually.
I know.
Just every time I read it, I think this says more and more negative things about me than anybody else. But every time I read it, I laugh.
It also has a cover that's very user-friendly, possibly too user-friendly, like frying eggs flying through the air. It's a kind of cartoonish cover. It's trying really, almost bending over backwards to look user-friendly. Having said that, it's a fantastic read for the everyday science of everyday things. And I loved it for that.
Now, Tracy, you're a novelist, most famous for historical novels, probably. Why were you judging this prize? What did you have to bring to it?
Well, my most recent novel was called Remarkable Creatures, and it was about the fossil hunter Mary Anning, early 19th century fossil hunter. And I had to do a lot of research in geology and paleontology, and in a way the history of science, the development of science. And I think the Royal Society was looking for somebody who's not a scientist but can sort of bridge the two. So I write for a more popular audience, but I also did scientific research. And also, I suppose I'm the expert on the panel of how to put a book together, how to tell a story, how to interest the public. Mm-hmm. And indeed, this is a popular science prize. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's what I was there for.
It's a very good point, that actually. And that brings us to one of the titles that I was very intrigued by, was God's Philosophers, which is, this is science history, isn't it? Which seems to be on a bit of a roll at the moment. Sarah?
Yes, I think for me it sort of came into focus with Bill Bryson's 2005 book, A Short History of Nearly Everything, which was written in his sort of signature folksy style. and was an extremely accessible trawl through the history of science.
And indeed won the Royal Society Prize that year.
And won the Royal Society Prize, yeah. And it was hugely popular. It sold over 300,000 copies. And I think it sort of laid the foundations with publishers and authors of this idea that science books can be bought by a wider book-buying public. And on this year's shortlist, we have, reflecting that, James Hannam's book, How the Medieval World Laid the Foundations for Modern Science, is the sort of subtitle of it. And in this week's review, Claire, there's a review of Jim Al-Khalili's book about the golden age of Arabic science, isn't there? Mm.
You could say this is a history book, but it's also a history of science, so there's a lot of science in it. And I really like the book because it... Most people think of medieval world and medieval science as an oxymoron. There was no science then. People were all superstitious. And this book goes a long way towards slaying that notion. So it gives you the all sorts of scientific principles that were developed at that time and then taken later on in later scientific discoveries. Mm-hmm.
Well, they all sound like very interesting books and ones that I should definitely add to my reading list. However, there is only one winner. And Tracy, please, would you do the honours?
Yes, the winner is Life Ascending by Nick Lane.
And we are absolutely delighted about that because we have backed this book right the way from first publication. Yeah. Tell us a bit about it.
It's a really elegant book. I think it's a book about all of the different building blocks that make up life. It takes natural selection as a given. So it's not a book that so many of the books on evolution this past year, the Darwin year, were trying to convince people that evolution and natural selection exists, trying to answer the creationists. This just takes it as a given. And it talks about 10 different subjects, 10 different ideas that evolution has put forward from the origin of life through DNA, the complex cell, sex, sight, hot blood, consciousness, all the way to death. So it's all these different ideas about how life is lived and how we developed, the world developed. And I think what I particularly loved about this book, a book needs for me to satisfy three things: story, style, and structure. This has a story. It tells you how life came into being, all of the new ideas about how life would come into being, going all the way to death. And it has it's written in beautifully, very clear style, very reasonably easy to understand. It's not easy. You're not written down to. It's quite hard going at times, but it's worth putting the effort into.
So it's not science light, like the title might suggest.
No. But most importantly, it's got an overarching structure that I think imitates human life. It's about the beginnings of life, and it goes all the way to death. And it asks questions like, why do we have to have sex to reproduce? You know, there are plenty of organisms that clone themselves. How come mammals, animals have sexual reproduction? How come we can see? How did sight develop? How did we get consciousness? Why are some animals cold-blooded and others hot-blooded? Why do we die? You know, cells replicate themselves. Why can't we just replicate ourselves forever and go on living forever? So it answers all these really deep questions, and I just thought it was fantastic. And I think what really did it for me, though, is that it's not enough to tell a story. You also have to think very hard about how you structure it. And so many writers don't, and I think that Nick Lane did very well in this. Mm-hmm.
Well, right back when the book was published, Nick Lane came in to talk to our science podcast team about the book.
Bacteria, they don't have sex in the same way that more complicated cells do, but they do swap genes, and it amounts to a form of sex. It's called lateral gene transfer, or just bacterial sex, if you like. And it serves much the same purpose. And so the question is, when you're able to reproduce clonally, as bacteria do, and get all the extra variation that you need by just picking it up from the environment, why go through this long, complicated process that's sex for larger organisms?
Which has energy costs. I mean, you talk about the peacock's tail, for example, which is just about display and obviously, it is about attracting mates. You talk about things like flowers, which are nothing
pure
but...
Pure cost, yes.
Pure cost, exactly. So this must be something
very
useful.
The cost all comes down to what John Maynard Smith years ago called the twofold cost of sex, and that's effectively that the cost of producing males. Why have men? Because a clonal organism just simply splits in half and you have two offspring from a single parent, if you like, and sex reverses that. You have two parents who produce one child, and 50% of those are men. What's the point?
Nick Lane, and congratulations to him. Life Ascending is published by Profile. Thanks very much, Tracy, for coming in. Well, right back when humanity had yet to come to consciousness, the Earth started laying down seams of the coal that we are all still mining today. You have only to look at the Chilean mine rescue drama of the last week to realise what a dirty and dangerous job it is to get the black stuff up to the surface again. Good reason, perhaps, not to memorialise it endlessly. Or is it? One man who has done just that is Peter Crookston, a one-time editor of The Observer magazine who has just published a book, The Pitmen's Requiem. He joins Sarah and me to talk about the international literary heritage of mining. We'll set the scene by returning with Martin Wainwright to Nottinghamshire.
Coal mining has played a hugely important part in British social and political history. It was the country's biggest industry, probably the most productive and certainly the most deadly. But it doesn't have a comparable place in English literature. There isn't an Emile Zola, there isn't a Germinal in English literature. There's one exception in terms of classic literature, though, and that's D.H. Lawrence. And I'm in Eastwood, the little town in North Nottinghamshire, where Lawrence was born and where he set some of his most famous books, notably Sons and Lovers, and Lady Chatterley's Lover, which takes place both in the town and in the very lovely countryside which surrounds the former pit village and still does. Councillor Bob Charlesworth is one of the councillors for... he actually represents Lady Chatterley's Woods, Eastwood North, and the countryside near the town.
Some of the older residents don't like Lawrence because, basically, he did not disguise very well the characters in the book. The older locals always refer to him as the dirty old man.
It's like I heard the mucky fella.
Yes.
But it was also, they felt he hadn't been sensitive about real people.
Oh, definitely. Some of the older people thought that. But those days of going now, there's not so many of them around.
Charles Robb, who's one of the other councillors for North Eastern, have you any Lawrence associations where you live? Are you close to any of the sites?
Actually, I live in one of the Lawrence houses.
Do you? Which one is that?
Lincroft. Mm-hmm. It was where he wrote his first book, The White Peacock, and his mother died in the front bedroom.
Goodness. And do you get people knocking at the door?
I've had found people walking down the hall. I've actually taken people in and given them tea and biscuits and spoke about the place.
Bob, you were just telling me about the street that you live in.
Yes, I live very close to where the Sons and Lovers house is, the family home that's mentioned quite a few times, and there's a passage in Sons and Lovers where he talks about hearing miners going to work and people coming from the pub at night, walking along a lane which in effect is now Walker Street, which must be 200 to 300 yards away. And if you're just talking with normal voices, without raised voices, on Walker Street on a quiet summer's night in our attic bedroom, you can hear the conversation.
And then he got that right.
Yes.
Do you think he's much read round here?
I studied just across the valley in Heena. And our English literature teacher very bravely actually chose Lady Chatterley's Lover. But she forgot that the great-nephew of Lawrence was actually in the class and was reading sections of the book out. And he, of course, read out part of the first edition, which is not the abridged edition, which the teacher had deliberately gave us, particularly when it got to some of the more spicy bits and duly embarrassed the teacher.
Well, here we are in Eastwood. Traffic going up the main street outside Durban House, which is the D.H. Lawrence Heritage Centre. This is the place which is in the news at the moment because the local council is having difficulty finding funding for it after the failure of a lottery bid. It's a heritage centre, which was once the office of the colliery manager. It's where the miners came to get their pay. It's where D.H. Lawrence went to get his father's pay. Quite a stiff walk back up the hill to his house, which is what I'm doing now. I'm in the birthplace. I paid my £2.50, which gets me into Durban House, I gather. It's Faye Bokes is going to show me around.
I've got proper gas lamps.
Is this the sort of place where there are scenes, aren't there, where they have a bath in front of the fire? And that would have been... Oh, here it is. So I haven't noticed it. Here is the bath.
Well, that's a hip bath. And Arthur would use that when he came back from the pit. That would be what he used to clean himself. So he'd eat first, and then he would wash in there. And, I mean, I don't know if you know, but Victorians didn't like to clean their backs. So because they thought it would weaken the back. So it literally would be his front. And there is a story that goes that when he came round, first came back from the pit, Lydia didn't recognise him because he was so covered
in filthy,
cold
so earth. Filthy. Do you find people are fond of him? You know, I know there was a time, you know, when he was not regarded with a lot of favour, partly because, you know, he was seen as smutty, and also I think people thought he was a bit too... you know, not very sensitive in his dealing with them, real people. But presumably that's all gone now. I mean,
there is in the local era, there is still a bit of animosity there, I mean, for some people. But in general, no, people do have a fondness here when they come, and a lot of people that do come are people that love Lawrence, or they're coming because they love the Victorian, or they remember it from their childhood.
Do you think we'll get another one? I mean, when you consider the drama that has taken place... in coal mining, you know, in my lifetime, I mean, the last 50 years, we haven't yet really had that depicted in fiction. I wonder if we will.
I don't know. I kind of think that Lawrence was kind of unique because of what happened to him. I mean, I suppose the class system doesn't really count now, but he went through... There are not many people that are mining that are ever going to go and write novels about the local area and things. I really can't see it happening, to be honest.
If you go to the National Coal Mining Museum for England, they've got probably the biggest collection of mining books. But if you're looking for literature, it's not altogether fulfilling, as I discovered. I'm with Nisha Christensen. Nisha, you've just kindly got out for me something very different, which is a Pitman's anthology.
Yes, and so you've obviously got J.B. Priestley, Lawrence, Zola, who isn't... English, but is obviously one of the main people that you would think of.
Germinal's the one I always think of. And I suppose, in a way, we don't have the equivalent to that in English. No. But we've got Lawrence. And there's a lot of stuff here, it seems to me, by people who are not household names. I mean, a lot of people have written minor novels and poetry.
Right. That's certainly the case. And if I take you into the store, you'll see that a lot of the fiction is by often ex-miners.
Yes, yes. Oh, this is great. Now we've got these big rolling stacks here.
This is the section where all the fiction is kept, and as you can see, lots of it is by ex-miners.
I mean, this is like a graveyard of novels that never really made it. Like, there's one here called Uncouth Swain by Roger de Talla, Honey and Bread by Rhys Davies. Oh, he did quite a few. Rings on Their Fingers by Rhys Davies, A Time to Laugh. Nisha, do you get many people coming in here to use the fiction?
No. It's one of the areas that can get lost, mainly because a lot of people come in for different reasons, you know, from family history to research to, you know, wanting to know what's happening now in mining.
Do you ever get people, you know, who want help with doing their memoirs or trying to write something based on mining?
Yes, that's part of, I suppose, appeal in a way, because lots of people kind of feel they can come to us and we'll help them with getting background information, for example, you know, when they're writing, or if they've forgotten, if they're writing their memories and or memoirs and they've forgotten facts, and, you know, they can get little bits of facts, like, for example, when a pit was opened and closed and that sort of thing, and how much it produced, or who was the under manager at the time, you know, that sort of thing.
Martin Wainwright with Anisha Christensen. Peter, J.B. Priestley and Robbie Burns figure in there, but actually there isn't that much mining literature in this country, is there?
There's some rather esoteric literature published up in the northeast. There's a very fine book called The Miners of Northumberland and Durham by a guy, I think it's Richard Fiennes. Anyway, he wrote a great history of the miners in that area, in which he revealed a lot of the perfidy of the mine owners and their oppression of the miners in the 1840s, when the very first miners' union was formed, called the Northern Federation of Miners. It became known as Hepburn's Union because it was formed by a man called Thomas Hepburn, who was a hewer at Hetton Colliery near Durham City. And he
went into the mines at the age of 8, and he seldom saw the sunlight. And he, when he formed his union, his first campaign was to reduce the working hours of children in the mines from 18 hours a day to 12 hours a day.
Oh, so shocking, isn't it? The idea of poor little children being down for 18 hours a day. Tell us a little bit about the Pitman's Requiem. What is the Pitman's Requiem?
It's a brass band tune called Gresford, and it was written to commemorate the 265 men and boys who were killed in an explosion at Gresford Colliery in North Wales in 1934. And it was written not by a Welshman, but by a Geordie, by Robert Saint, who I met when I was 10 years old in 1946. And my father said, he's a famous Hebburn man. And I asked him why. And he said, it's because he wrote Gresford. And then years later, I was at the Durham Miners Gala, and I heard Gresford played. They play it there a lot because it commemorates the death of many miners, and it's become the official hymn of the National Union of Mine Workers, to whom Robert Saint bequeathed his royalties. He didn't bequeath them. He gave them while he was still alive for the upkeep and maintenance of the Durham aged miners' homes.
There's a nice little thing on a YouTube of Tony Benn talking about why it's so important to him. That's Sarah, you're from a mining area. Does it bring a tear to your eyes?
It does a bit. I'm feeling a bit tearing up just thinking about it. Yes, I come from around Newcastle, and I have my own sort of particular personal connection with mining, which is a literary one, happily enough for this podcast. I named my son, actually, after a character in an amazing children's book, which no one has ever heard of apart from me, called The Bonny Pit Laddie, called Frederick Grice. And I went to school in Newcastle, and it was a book that we read in school. And it's the story set in a pit village in County Durham in the early 20th century. And it's the story of this boy, Dick Ullathorne, who slowly realises that he doesn't want to go down the pit like his dad did and his brother did. But I actually named my son after his brother, Kit, who I had a complete crush on when I was a nine-year-old. And he was just, you know, he was really cool and really brave. When the Chilean mine disaster happened, I was really kind of put in mind of this book again, because they have a similar disaster in the book, you know, a caving in of the mine shaft, the miners are trapped underground and can't get out. And it's Kit who finally sort of leads them to safety.
Of course, we've also got, more recently, David Armand writing very much from a mining background.
Yes, absolutely.
Another and Kit.
It's another Kit, yes. His book, Kit's Wilderness, is all set in Northumberland, in the mine, sort of in County Northumberland. And he is somebody who comes from the northeast of England, is very sort of grounded in the literature and tradition of that area. And so, but you know, brings mines into his work very naturally, as somebody who grew up around there would do.
Peter, had you heard of the Bonny Pit Laddie?
I've heard of the song.
Go on, you're going to sing it for us?
Well, if you insist. Actually, I'll sing at the drop of a hat, being a Geordie. I've travelled east and I've travelled west, and I have been to Kirkcaldy, but the bonniest lass I ever have seen was Follian a Collier Laddie.
Bravo, bravo. Sarah's got all teary again. We're not particularly good at honouring our miners, are we? We're not as good as some other countries.
No, I don't think we are. I think in the northeast there's a great tradition of honouring them, but I don't think it exists. Well, hang on a minute. Let me think about it.
We don't think of Zola, for example, Germinal. That's a great novel, isn't it?
About. Well, Lawrence did write Sons and Lovers, which is very good on mining. And, of course, Orwell wrote that terrific The Road to Wigan Pier, in which there's a wonderful description of mining. But, no, there isn't a sort of classic book all about mining.
Peter, I was really surprised, have long been surprised, that no great novels came out of the miners' strike in the 1980s. It seems that very little was written about that.
Well, there's a wonderful non-fiction book. A Guardian journalist wrote a wonderful book called The Enemy Within, Mrs. Thatcher and the Miners' Strike, which is the most brilliant expose of how the miners were really framed by the security services, and how, you know, they were made to look as if they got money from Colonel Gaddafi, and Scargill had paid off his mortgage, and all of which was subsequently proven to be wrong, and editors who had printed this, notably the Daily Mirror under Robert Maxwell, had to print retractions and apologies.
Do you think that there's anything about the fact that there was such a huge investment in those areas in terms of education? I mean, I started work in the South Wales Valleys, and there was a great tradition of miners' institutes and adult education. As that has shrunk,
well, it has.
Those voices aren't coming out.
I'm afraid it has, because, well, first of all, the mines have gone. But even while the mines were disappearing, that whole mining culture was dying, as Sid Chaplin, another Guardian writer, observed in The Guardian. He wrote a piece which ended with a sentence something like, "As I left the village, I noticed the bluish light in every parlour from the flickering television screen." And it was television, really, which came in the 50s in the Northeast, which stopped people reading. I mean, they used to read at night. They would go to the library, they'd go to the institute, the Miners' Institute, and get books out and read. And there was a great culture of self-improvement. Two of the people in my book were products of this self-improvement. Their father was called William Keegan, and William Keegan Jr. is the economics commentator.
Bill
Keegan,
own Bill.
Your own Bill. He's the economics commentator of The Observer, and his brother is...
Vic, of course.
Yeah, well, he was a leader writer on The Guardian. Before that, he was the economics editor of The Guardian. Now, they are both the sons of a miner from County Durham who... Bill told me, had on his shelves Dickens, Robbie Burns, Omar Khayyam, and the Odham's Press self-improvement encyclopedia. So there was this great culture of self-improvement, which you also come across, of course, in The Pitman Painters by Lee Hall.
Ah, yes, play that was at the National.
That's right. It's now, would you believe it, on Broadway. And it's wowing them on Broadway. How they understand the Geordie dialect in the play, God only knows, but they seem to do it because it got a standing ovation on its first night.
Well, that's it for today's podcast. Thanks to Tracy Chevalier, Peter Crookston and Martin Wainwright. Do tune in next week for news on the impact of this week's comprehensive spending review. In the meantime, in The Guardian's review on Saturday, Martin Amis looks at Philip Larkin's Women, while Geoffrey Robertson, QC, commemorates 50 years since the Chatterley ban. Until next week, thanks for listening. I'm Claire Armistead, and the producer is Tim Mabey. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.